If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. I'm delighted to be joined today by Dr. Paul Offit. Dr. Offit is one of the nation's foremost experts on vaccines and vaccine misinformation. He is the co-inventor of the rotavirus vaccine, and he's the author of countless scholarly articles, as well as a number of general circulation books on health, vaccines, and where modern medicine has gotten things wrong. His most recent book is Deadly Choices, How the Anti-Vaccine Movement Threatens Us All. Dr. Offit, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you.
I'd like to just begin by setting the stage and asking you to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself, how you became interested in medicine, and specifically, what drew you to the whole vaccine debate?
Well, I think the real answer to that question is I'm a child of the 50s. When I was 5 years old, I had a operation on my right foot that didn't go well. It was sort of a congenital abnormality. And so it landed me in a chronic care facility, an orthopedic facility called Kernan's Hospital for Crippled Children, because that was back in the days when you could use words like crippled and feeble-minded in the name of children's hospitals. Yeah. So I was there for about 6 weeks. And when you're in an orthopedic, a chronic care facility in the mid-1950s, you're in a polio ward. So I remember polio. You know, there was one visiting hour a week. I remember children in iron lungs. I remember the so-called Sister Kenny hot pack treatments, where they would take these excruciatingly hot packs and put them on withered arms and legs so children were screaming. It was really a Dickens book. And it was scarring. I do think I was scarred by that experience. And I saw those children, as I think I came to see myself, was sort of vulnerable and helpless and alone. And I think that's what drew me to pediatrics. I think it's what drew me to pediatric infectious diseases. I think the first book that I wrote was actually about sort of a polio vaccine gone wrong in the mid-1950s called the Cutter Incident. I think all of that was this. And I think it's what drives me today. I think my passion today in defending children is because I see myself in them at some level.
That's so interesting. Thank you. So let's discuss a little bit about the world before widely available vaccines. So you mentioned what kids with polio suffered. Can you give us some statistics about how many, before the polio vaccine became widely available, how many American kids would get it every year? How many would get very sick? How many be paralyzed? And how many would die?
Well, for polio, as many as 30,000 a year would be paralyzed. About 1,800 would die. But I can give you in 40 seconds a 100-year overview of infectious diseases.
Okay, great.
So my parents were children of the 1920s. Their parents, my grandparents, were scared of diphtheria, which would kill 15,000 people a year, and they were scared of pertussis or whooping cough, which would kill 8,000 a year. I am a child, as were my brother and sister, of the 1950s. So my parents weren't scared of those two diseases because we had vaccines for them. Mm-hmm. But I had measles, mumps, German measles and chickenpox. And my parents were scared of measles because it would cause 50,000 hospitalizations and about 500 deaths a year. Mumps was the most common cause of acquired deafness. German measles, when it infected women in the first trimester of pregnancy, would result in an 85% chance of a child with severe permanent congenital anomalies like deafness, blindness, and heart defects. Now, when I was a pediatric resident in the late 70s, I would do 2 to 3 spinal taps a night when I was on call in the emergency department. Today, residents don't
wait. Know. What were they for?
So they were for bacterial infections like Haemophilus influenza B or meningococcus or pneumococcus. Residents today, pediatric residents at my hospital, don't know how to do spinal taps. They don't. When a child comes in and needs a spinal tap, they let an interventional radiologist do it because we now have those vaccines. My children are children of the 90s, and my wife and I weren't scared of any of these diseases because we had vaccines, and that's the problem. I think because we're really no longer scared of these diseases, we focus on safety issues, real or imagined.
I think I once saw a documentary about the polio vaccine. I think there were two. There was the Salk and then the Sabin vaccine. I'm pretty sure I got the Sabin as an elementary school student.
Can I ask you what year you were born?
I was born in 1957.
Yeah, so you would have gotten the Salk vaccine.
I got the Salk? Okay, because they put in a little sugar cube swallowed it.
I'm older than you, but I suspect what you got was in 57, you would have gotten the Salk vaccine.
Okay. So, anyway, I watched this documentary and it was very graphic about what kids with polio suffered and that iron lung experience was just horrific. These are kids who couldn't breathe on their own because the virus attacked the muscles of the diaphragm, right? Anyway, so it was very graphic, but then it was very moving because at the end, there was a description that when the vaccine was finally approved, that simultaneously across the country, church bells rang out in celebration. And people were so thrilled and so grateful to be liberated from this nightmare of fear of this terrible disease. Okay. So now we fast forward to our own time, and in your book, Deadly Choices, you talk about how people began to get misinformation about vaccine safety. So let's start with the fact that no vaccine is, without some consequences, right? I mean, even ones that we regarded as safe, there's going to be some percentage of people who have a bad reaction, right?
Yes, and sometimes a very bad reaction. Yes, you're right.
Okay, so talk about the weighing of those things with, for example, diphtheria or the MMR vaccine. Like how many kids how many kids are protected versus how many are going to have a bad reaction, even possibly including death?
So the diphtheria vaccine, as an example, is really a single protein vaccine. It's just one protein made by diphtheria bacteria that is then inactivated with a chemical. So it's really pretty safe. I mean, you can get pain or redness or tenderness at the site of injection. Sometimes you can get sort of low-grade fever or achiness, but that's about as bad as it gets. With measles or mumps or German measles, those are live weakened viral vaccines. So they can cause somewhat more significant reactions. So the measles vaccine, for example, can lower your platelet count. Platelets are a type of cell in your circulation that helps clotting. And maybe 10 or 14 days after, about 1 in 35,000 people will get this lowering of platelet counts. Probably the most serious side effect from a vaccine was one we've just talked about, which was Albert Sabin's oral polio vaccine. So we started using that in 1960, early 60, 61 to 63. And then we stopped using it in the year 2000. And the reason is this. It was rare, but it was real that roughly 1 per 2.4 million children who got that vaccine could be paralyzed by it. In other words, the vaccine itself could cause paralysis. So although we eliminated polio from this country by 1979, throughout the 1980s, throughout the 1990s, every year 8 to 10 children would be paralyzed by polio vaccine. The only cause of polio in this country throughout the 80s and 90s was the polio vaccine. And so that's why we stopped using it in the year 2000, switched back to Sabin's vaccine, which was just that live, that whole killed virus vaccine.
Okay. So basically, after they eliminated the Sabin vaccine for polio, they were just giving the salt?
Yeah. We've been using that for the last 25 years.
Okay. And so we had basically eliminated polio, but now it's back, right?
So there was one case of polio in this country in a 27-year-old man in Rockland County in 2022. And the cause of his polio was actually that vaccine virus that's still around. I mean, mm-hmm. many countries still use the oral polio vaccine. International travel is common. So people can come into this country shedding that virus, the oral polio vaccine virus, which very rarely but truly can revert to essentially paralytic type. And also only about one of 200 people who get infected with polio will be paralyzed by the virus. So when you see mm-hmm. that paralysis in Rockland County in 2022, he's the tip of a much bigger outbreak. Actually, the Gaza polio outbreak now is caused by that strain, that revertant mm-hmm. Polio virus vaccine strain.
Okay. We now have a Secretary of Health and Human Services who has his own very extreme views about vaccines. And I want to get into your sense of it because you have tangled with him personally. RFK Jr., you wrote about this on your Substack. RFK Jr. came to you in basically what was a sandbagging kind of interview. You thought he was acting in good faith. You thought, oh, Robert F. Kennedy, I liked his father. You know, I'll talk to him. So tell us that story. And what year was that?
2004. So it was more than 20 years ago. He called me and he said there were people, parents who were coming to his office who were scared about this ethyl mercury containing preservative called thimerosal that was in vaccines as a preservative. So when you have a multi-dose vial and you keep violating, you know, the stopper with a syringe and needle so that for the 8th, 9th, 10th dose, sometimes you can introduce bacteria, which can be harmful. So you need some sort of preservative. So here was ethyl mercury that was being used as a preservative. Now this was like 2004. So for the most part, thimerosal was out of vaccines given to young children in this country, to children under 4. So it wasn't there anymore. Western Europe had taken thimerosal out of vaccines in the early 90s. There were Canadian provinces that use this preservative in some vaccines, right next to Canadian provinces that use the same vaccines that didn't contain it. So it was really easy to do these experiments. There were a lot of natural experiments out there, and they were done. There were probably about 5 studies that had been done that showed that it was in no way harmful. I mean, mercury is never going to sound good. It's not like there's, you know, the National Center for the Appreciation of Heavy Metals standing up in defense of mercury. But it was easy to do. Besides, don't remember, you're exposed to mercury all the time. I mean, assuming you live, I don't know you, but I'm going to assume you live on this planet.
And if
you
I do, on the surface, yes.
There you go. So if mercury is in the Earth's crust. And and it comes up to the surface via sort of rock erosion or volcanoes. It's taken up by bacteria. It's methylated, which means it's organic mercury, which means it can cross cell membranes and do harm. And methyl mercury can do harm. But you have far more mercury, assuming you, again, eat, drink anything made from water on this planet, that you are going to be exposed to mercury all the time. And the mercury that was in thimerosal added nothing to what you already was the burden of mercury. So it was really easy to do these experiments. So I had a long conversation with him. I thought it went great. I went to my wife that night. I said, this is great. You know, I had a really good conversation with a man whose father I certainly admired. And then, you know, whatever, I think July the following year, 2005, he published an article in Rolling Stone and he sandbagged me. He said that I was a liar and I was lying about the only reason that I said that I defended mercury because I was working on a vaccine, which actually hadn't been out yet. It wouldn't be out till 2006. But he said the only reason I said that because the vaccine I was working on, this rotavirus vaccine, was laced with thimerosal. That's what it said in the article, laced with thimerosal. First of all, no live weakened viral vaccines contain a preservative. So that was wrong anyway. And I called up the head of or the editor-in-chief or whatever, Rolling Stone, and said, your article is wrong. It's just all these misstatements of fact. They eventually withdrew it, but it took a while.
They did withdraw it. Well, and Salon too, right? Didn't That's Salon right. pick it up That's as well? Right. And they both withdrew it?
Yes.
Yeah, probably... nobody noticed the withdrawal and everybody read the article, but that's the world we live in. So before we get deeper into the problem of that is RFK Jr. and everything he represents, let's talk a little bit about how this whole idea that vaccines cause autism got started. There was a doctor named Andrew Wakefield. Tell us that story.
Right. So in February of 1998, there was a British gastroenterological surgeon named Andrew Wakefield who published a paper in The Lancet, which was a very good general medical journal, well-respected medical journal. And it was a report of 12 children, eight of whom had autism within a month, supposedly, of receiving this combination measles, mumps, rubella, or MMR vaccine. That was it. And that was really the whole paper. It was not, it was just an association. Got a vaccine, have signs and symptoms of autism. Remember, the vaccine is given between 12 and 15 months of age. So that's around the time that, you know, signs or symptoms of autism are detected by parents. So the nicest thing you could say was that he raised the hypothesis. I mean, you might have had a paper that said, here's eight children who recently ate a peanut butter and jelly sandwich and within a month developed signs and symptoms of autism, because there was no control group. But you don't know whether this occurred more in a vaccine.
Can I interrupt you, though, and just ask, if that's all there was to this article, I'm wondering, why did The Lancet publish it? You know, it seems like, I mean, it was Aristotle, I believe, who established that post hoc ergo propter hoc is a logical fallacy. So we've kind of known that for about 2,500 years. I'm wondering, like, why a paper that said, well, this followed that, therefore it's possible that this was caused by that, would have been published by a prestigious medical journal.
So the editor-in-chief was Richard Horton, who was, I think, friends with Andrew Wakefield. He knew him, and he thought he would kind of modify the effect of that by having an editorial that was published by two CDC researchers that said, look, there's no control group here. He can't say anything about causality. This is just, you know, this may well all be coincidence. You need to do the kind of studies where children either did or didn't get the vaccine to see whether the incidence of autism is greater in the vaccinated group. And I guess he thought, at least naively, that that this would modify the reaction, which was the opposite of what happened. I mean, it took off. You know, there were thousands of people in the United Kingdom that chose not to give their children MMR vaccine. There were hundreds that were hospitalized, and there were four that died of measles. I mean, you could argue that paper killed four children in the United Kingdom. And then it spread across the Atlantic Ocean, and parents of at least 250,000 children here chose not to give the MMR vaccine. So although we eliminated measles from this country in the year 2000, eliminated, this was 2 years after that paper was published, that paper and its effects and its aftermath really caused an erosion in vaccine rates. So that now, you know, you have a huge outbreak in West Texas where there's 128 cases, or sorry, 228 cases and two deaths. I mean, this is, and nobody has trumpeted the notion that MMR causes autism more than our current Secretary of Health and Human Services.
Right, which is just mind-blowing. Let's just to close the loop there on Wakefield. So The Lancet withdrew the paper later, right, and repudiated it, I think. And Wakefield was found to be guilty of some kind of corruption, right?
Well, first of all, they retracted it far too late. I mean, they retracted like 10 years later, which I think was not great. But so yeah. he had received hundreds of thousands of dollars from a legal services commission to basically launder legal claims through a medical journal. I mean, there were a number of children or parents of the children in that study, if you want to call it a study. It was really just a case series that were in the midst of suing pharmaceutical companies. He also had a patent on a quote-unquote safer measles vaccine, which he neglected to mention to his co-authors. And he had misrepresented biological data. He had misrepresented clinical data. There was at least one child who actually had developed symptoms of autism before he ever got the vaccine. So he had sort of a bias. And so he put it out there as this paper. And he also he's very well-spoken. He's attractive. He's got a British accent, which I think sells in this country.
It does.
So I think he was a powerful advocate for this false notion.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable Pocket Hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
So a combination of things. One that we've spoken about, which is that once you conquer these diseases, and most people don't remember the fear of the disease or the consequences of it, people get lazy or complacent. So we've got complacency. We also have the proliferation of a certain kind of huckster like Wakefield, who has personal profit and other things in mind. You have lazy gatekeepers at places like The Lancet and Rolling Stone and other outlets. And then you have the proliferation of these parents' movements, where the parents get very frightened because they see movies and documentaries and doing their own research on the internet about potential damage from vaccines. So talk, if you would, about these parents' movements, how they got started, and where we stand with them.
Well, so the anti-vaccine movement, if you will, was born of the first vaccine, which was the smallpox vaccine in the late 1700s. There was something called the Anti-Vaccination League, which sprung up in the early 1800s for the same reason we see them today, which is people don't like to be told to vaccinate themselves. They don't like to have to be told by the federal government or state or any government that they need to inject themselves or be injected with a biological agent. And so even today, in many ways, if you ask anti-vaccine activists what they want, they'll all say, just make vaccines optional. Do not in any sense require them for school. Don't require them for the military. Don't require vaccines. So I think that it really got its start, though, in America in the early 1980s, when there was a film that was produced by NBC called DPT Vaccine Roulette. DPT stands for diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus vaccine, although technically it's actually DTP. But in any case, it worked well here for this, because eventually the group that formed was called Dissatisfied Parents Together. So it was a frightening film. I mean, parents all told the same story. Look, my child was fine. They got this vaccine. Now look at them. And you would see children seizing and drooling and looking vacantly up at the sky with withered arms and legs. It was a frightening film. And all the parents said the same thing. My child was fine. Here's this vaccine that did this. And I think we were surprised. I think the academic and public health community was surprised that suddenly people thought vaccines were doing more harm than good. It was sort of unimaginable, because here, if you like, the whooping cough vaccine, which is what was blamed here, was, you know, eliminated 8,000 deaths that occurred every year. People assumed that everybody would have appreciated that. And so there were no new studies. Eventually, were done, you know, retrospective studies where you could see whether you were at greater risk of having the kinds of things that were claimed in that film, and wasn't. But that did a lot of harm. It caused a flood of litigation. It drove vaccine makers off the market. It went from like 18 vaccine makers in 1980 to 4 by the end of the decade, because they just left. The business wasn't worth it for them to handle that kind of litigation, because vaccines are not big money makers. And they're something you give once or a few times in a lifetime. They're never going to compete with things like lipid lowering agents, et cetera. So
right.
That was the first big hit. And I think Wakefield was the second big hit. in the late 1990s with that paper claiming MMR caused autism.
Among the people, among the opportunists, one might say, who've come along and made the anti-vaccine movement their own and contributed to it, honestly, I mean, RFK Jr., you mentioned the four kids who died of measles. RFK Jr. arguably also has blood on his hands because of what he did in Samoa, where there was an outbreak and it was largely the result of vaccine misinformation. And he actually went to Samoa and encouraged the very worst fears of the parents. And something like 80 kids died of measles in Samoa. But so he now, because we live in crazy land, he now is the head of our largest health agency in America. So I'd like to walk through some of the things that he is doing. And some of them, I think you have a direct effect on you. Like, you are on the vaccine advisory committee, right? That's just been postponed, disbanded. What did he do there?
So I'm on the FDA vaccine advisory committee. We usually meet in mid-March to pick influenza strains for the coming year. It's a six-month production cycle. So we pick the strains, we inform the pharmaceutical companies which strains to use in the vaccine. It's a six-month production cycle, so it's available then in September. So the meeting was just canceled. And they decided the FDA, I guess, is just going to take this in-house and do it without external advisors.
And the reason he doesn't want external advisors is that he says you all are in the pockets of Big Pharma. Can you talk about that?
He's a conspiracy theorist. He believes, first of all, he believes vaccines cause autism. And even though there have been probably two dozen studies done in seven countries on three continents involving thousands of children, he doesn't believe it. He believes that all these researchers, international researchers, all deeply in the pocket of the pharmaceutical industry. He's a personal injury lawyer. That's what they do, right? They just blame something that everybody's going to hate, in this case, Big Pharma. And there's reason to hate Big Pharma, don't get me wrong. I just think, who's he at here? I mean, I think his notion is that the reason that he believes vaccines are doing far more harm than good, that's what he said.
He said there's no safe vaccine.
There's no vaccine to benefit, no vaccine to benefit, no vaccine safe. He said the polio vaccine killed many, many, many more people than it saved. He says when he sees a parent walking along a hiking path carrying a child, he'll walk up to that parent and say, don't vaccinate this child. And he believes he saved that child. He is a virulent anti-vaccine activist. He is sure vaccines are doing harm. And the only reason that the American public doesn't know that is because he's going to pull the curtain back and show all this sort of people who are rife with conflicts, who aren't telling the truth because they're just pocketing money. So that's his notion, for which there's no evidence, by the way. I mean, I've known these. I was on the advisory committee for immunization practices to the CDC between 98 and 2003. I'm on this committee now. We've made a lot of really good recommendations. I mean, the ACIP has been around since the early 60s. I mean, We've had the HIV vaccine, the pneumococcal vaccine, the meningococcal vaccine, the rotavirus vaccine. I mean, we have increased our lifespan by 30 years because of vaccines. What are you talking about?
And by the way, what's going to happen with the flu vaccine this year? So your committee didn't meet. Who's going to make the decisions? And are they going to have the right information to choose? I gather every year you have to choose the correct strain. You have to predict which one you think is going to be the most predominant and then mix the vaccine with that in mind. Are we all in danger of a bad flu season that come this fall?
Well,
no,
it might be a bad flu season.
But I mean, because of that lack of vaccines or
no,
the wrong one. No.
I think they'll follow the WHO recommendation, which is often what happens anyway. I think that what the public loses in this is that when you have these external advisory committees, it's experts in the field who can have by law no association with the government or the pharmaceutical industry. You have to sign forms to that effect. And then it's not only that we pick strains, but we also do a postmortem on the previous year. I mean, this is a bad flu year in the United States this year. You know, we've had close to 20,000 deaths this year. You've had hundreds of thousands of hospitalizations. And in part, it was because of a mismatch between the circulating strains and the vaccine strains. What did we get wrong? Why did we get it wrong? Let's go back and look at the data that we had available last year and see if there's any way we could have made a better pick. And that's all open to the public. I mean, it's a public meeting and you can watch it online if you want. So that's what's lost. For all of RFK Jr.'s discussion about transparency and radical transparency, he sort of pushes this all behind closed doors. And I wonder whether he's going to do the same thing with the CDC vaccine advisory committees.
Oh, and he has said that from now on, the HHS is not going to open up things for public comment the way it's been doing since the early 1960s. Which I had thought, I went to law school, I had thought that that was part of the Administrative Procedure Act and that all agencies had to abide by public comment rules before passing regulations. So I'm not sure that that's legal, what he's saying, but he is now suggesting, Mr. Transparency is now saying he's going to close off the public comment sections. But he's also saying that they're going to spend taxpayer money to do new studies on the link between vaccines and autism. So you were saying, about how many studies would you say have already been done on this idea?
15 and 18. Roughly.
Okay. Okay. And, you know, I was rolling my eyes about the idea of spending taxpayer money on such a thing since it's obviously not needed and the results are in and we know that there's no link, to the best of our knowledge. But somebody online, it's Pope Hat, who does legal commentary. He said they're going to falsify the results.
Right. He's right.
And that's what I thought. I thought, of course, there's no other reason to do this, is there?
Here's how you know this is true.
Okay.
If you watch this Senate confirmation hearing in front of the HELP committee, RFK Jr. was asked by both Senator Sanders and Senator Cassidy from Louisiana, do you agree that the evidence is solid, clear, that vaccines don't cause autism? And he said no, that he didn't agree with that, that if there was a good study, he would believe it. So then at the end of that meeting, he holds up this quote unquote study, which was not published in a medical journal or a scientific journal. It was not peer reviewed. It was funded by an anti-vaccine activist group. And it was horribly flawed. There were all these confounding variables that weren't accounted for. It was a useless paper. That's why it was never published by two authors who generally have their papers retracted. And this to him was a high quality study. That tells you everything you need to know about why he's doing the study. He wants to try and shoehorn his fixed, immutable, science-resistant hypothesis into a study where he's going to hold up, scare people even more about measles-containing vaccine in the midst of an epidemic where we've had two deaths among 228 people. That's a 1% mortality rate. That's 10 times higher than the normal mortality rate.
So so we have RFK Jr.'s idée fixe, you know, his inability to be persuaded by evidence. So I'm wondering, so you're on the inside, you know these people. What is the reaction in the medical world, in the scientific community? I mean, don't people have their hair on fire? Why isn't there more of a, you know, rebellion and saying this is completely bonkers? We've turned the page back to, you know, 1650. Where's the outcry?
Right. So you're saying Project 2025 should be Project 1825.
No, yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
I think people are a little scared. That's my sense of it. I think people who work for hospitals or universities or medical schools, all of which receive federal funds, are a little scared that what they perceive as a vindictive administration, that in any ways, if they speak out, that they would be punished. I really do think that's what's going to, because I just had somebody call me today from a group called Vaccinate Your Family, who said, where is everybody? He said, where is everybody? Mm-hmm. Where's the American Academy of Pediatrics? Where's the American Medical Association? Where's the American Association of Public Health? Where are these associations? Because everybody's standing back because they're a little scared, I think.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. And you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Host. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethost.com/terms.
Well, that's very discouraging because a little courage would go a long way here. We need people who are responsible and who know things to correct misinformation. And if they don't, then they're actually partly to blame for what happens, aren't they?
So you'll visit me in jail then?
Yeah, I sure will. Only if you'll reciprocally visit me because I've been an outspoken critic. So as recently as 2021, RFK Jr., the head of our health agency, petitioned to withdraw authorization for all COVID vaccines. His lawyer petitioned to withdraw authorization for the polio vaccine. We just named one really awful potential thing that is on the horizon. Namely, there's going to be a new study that's going to come out under the auspices of the federal government that is going to show that there is a link between the MMR vaccine and autism. It's going to be faked, but it's going to be out there. But what else do you see as potential public health effects of this administration? What are you worried about?
So there's the Vaccine for Children's program, which purchases between 50 and 55% of all vaccines given primarily to children who are uninsured or underinsured. But they're, the government's a big buyer of vaccines. And he would be, in a sense, in charge of that program. I mean, it's a congressional program, but he could decide who gets money and how. There's the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, which at least serves as a little bit of a firewall between the person who receives the vaccines and the company. You can always sue pharmaceutical companies. You just have to go through this program first.
Wait. Let's slow down. Can we just dwell on that for just a sec? Because I think it's important. This ties in with what I was asking about earlier. So there are some people who are going to be harmed by any vaccine, right? And this is a program that's there so that you don't have too many people suing. So that you don't have so many people suing the pharmaceutical companies that they stop making vaccines, which would be bad for public health. Do I have that right?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Okay. So, and how will Robert F. Kennedy affect the vaccine? What is it? Vaccine Victims and Something Fund? What is that?
All right, it's called the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program.
Okay.
So what he could do is he could say, I think MMR causes autism. Let's make that a compensable injury.
Let's take
these vaccines out of the program and just subject them to the slings and arrows of outrageous civil litigation.
Okay.
Let's change the label. I mean, he could do that. He is a personal injury lawyer who has spent the last few years of his life suing pharmaceutical companies and making money for it, or at least referring his personal injury lawyer friends so he can get a finder's fee. This is how he makes his living.
By the way, talk about being, being compromised by your corporate connections. That's him.
And that's right? I don't know if you heard that Elizabeth Warren sort of grilled him on his obvious conflicts of interest. This is what personal injury lawyers do. I mean, they just attack. If the law's on your side, argue the law. Facts on your side, argue the facts. Neither on your side, attack the witness. So that's what he's doing. He's saying, look at all these people who are making decisions about vaccines that are just lying to you. Actually, the most depressing email I got about a week ago is from a nurse in Ontario that said she was seeing a one-month-old. And she was explaining to the parents that in a month, that when the child was 2 months of age, the child was going to be getting this vaccine and this vaccine and this vaccine. And the father said, and I quote, I'm not anti-vaccine, but I want to wait to see what vaccines Robert F. Kennedy Jr. recommends before I get any.
Oh, my God. Yeah. No, so that's another thing. I mean, he does have tremendous influence and suasion with the public. So it's almost guaranteed that the level of vaccine resistance is going to rise with his public messaging, right?
It had already, I mean, for 20 years, he's used his name, his famous name, as his platform. And now I think any reasonable person could say, why would he be Secretary of Health and Human Services unless he was right at some level?
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. Okay. So you're worried about him changing the labels or saying this, you know, that this is no longer safe, and then opening up the vaccine makers to litigation, and then we would have real shortages. It wouldn't be the first time, right? We have had shortages of vaccines in the past. I was reading about it in your book. Talk about that, because people should know what could be coming.
I don't think people realize that this is a fragile market. I mean, the fact that there were 27 vaccine makers in the mid-50s, by the early 80s, there were 18. Now there's essentially four. If these are such huge money makers, how come everybody's abandoning the business? I mean, these vaccines are something you give once or a few times in your lifetime. They're never going to compete with drugs you give every day. Those are the real blockbusters. Now, which is not to say that vaccines don't make money. I mean, if they weren't making money for these companies, the companies wouldn't make them. Like, these companies are their shareholders, not their stakeholders, for sure.
Right.
But they're not big money makers. I mean, it's fragile enough that there are shortages. It's fragile enough that companies do abandon vaccines. So I think people don't quite realize that. While pharmaceutical companies have acted certainly aggressively and ethically and at times illegally, there's probably nothing worse than the opioid crisis to show you how pharmaceutical companies essentially captured agencies that should have been regulating them. I just don't see that in the vaccine world. I don't. I've been in the vaccine world for a long time, and I just see a lot of people trying to do the right thing for the right reasons.
That's something that I know most MAGA people certainly, and many others too, would roll their eyes at and say, oh, come on, you know, don't take us for chumps. We're not naive. Everybody is corrupt. Everybody is only in it for the worst reasons. Everybody's been bought. So I would like you to expand just a little bit. I mean, you talked about your own life story and how it affected your career choices. My feeling is, you know, I've lived in the world a good long time now. And yeah, there are lots of corrupt people and there are lots of bad people. There are also tremendous numbers of people who are well motivated, who genuinely want to be good people and to do good for others. I think most people who are drawn to the, not all, of course, but most people who are drawn to the helping professions genuinely want to help other people. How do you react to that?
I think that's right. I mean, I am cocooned in a world, an academic world, where, you know, I basically just, you know, inoculated mice in a windowless room at the Wistar Institute for, you know, 20 years, which I'm sure is not probably a great way to understand the world. But my understanding for the people I work with is that they're scientists. I mean, I'm functionally a scientist. And why do you go into science? Because it's interesting and it's fun. It really is. I mean, there's this like 1,000-piece puzzle and you're trying to understand it. In my case, rotavirus was a ubiquitous virus, and it doesn't matter where you live, the level of hygiene in your home or sanitation in your country, everybody's infected by rotavirus by the time they're 10 years old. Everybody.
Can you just describe some of the symptoms? Because it's a nasty bug.
Nasty bug. It causes fever, vomiting, and diarrhea, usually in the first couple of years of life. And children, because they have those three, that triad of fever, vomiting, and diarrhea, they can rapidly get dehydrated. It is a rapidly dehydrating illness. And because vomiting is a critical part of that illness, it's very hard to rehydrate children. So they can become dehydrated quickly. In this country, we'd have 70 to 75,000 hospitalizations every year from dehydration. We'd have 400 hospitalizations in our hospital, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, every winter. And it would kill maybe 60 children a year in this country. But in the world, it's the biggest killer of infants and young children. You know, 2,000 children die a day, about 500,000 a year die of rotavirus. And so I saw a child die of rotavirus in my residency, and I always had that in my mind. And when I got to Children's Hospital of Philadelphia and they were working on rotaviruses, I couldn't wait to be part of that. But you know, when you do it, just so you understand how you think, your goal is to publish papers so that you can get grants, so that you can get another grant, so you can ultimately like put your children through school. That's basically
right.
Your goal, okay?
Right.
And so we developed a small animal model to study the disease, mice. We figured out which part of the virus makes you sick, what part of the virus induces an immune response is protective. We created strains that we thought could be a vaccine, thus summarizing 26 years of work in about 40 seconds. And then now we thought we had something that could be a vaccine. So we went to different pharmaceutical companies. Merck ultimately said, okay, we'll try and move this forward. And we did the research was maybe 10 years, and then the research of development, you know, get the right number of strains, get the right dose, get the right number of doses, get the right buffering agent, stabilizing agent, real-time stability studies, right vial. It was an oral vaccine, that for 16 years. And then, you know, it became a vaccine. And that was amazing. I mean, I just, and, but
you. And what about the safety? I mean, you know, how did you have to prove that it was safe?
Right. So it's a series of, you go through phase one, phase two, phase three trials, progressively bigger trials. The big phase three trials, it was a 70,000 person prospective placebo controlled 11 country 4-year trial. And that proves that you don't have an uncommon serious side effect, but you don't know whether or not it's going to be a rare serious side effect. And it's interesting, you know, the old Chinese proverb is when the gods were angry, they grant your wish. That's how me and Mike at the time, coworker Fred Clark felt when, so now it's about to be licensed and recommended, which means millions of people are going to get it. And you're scared to death. I mean, Fred and I were looking through all these gene databases thinking, what did we not think about? Is there something our vaccine could do that we hadn't thought about? And, you know, you're nervous about all that. And then finally, you know, the vaccine comes out and it's clearly working. It's estimated to save about 165,000 lives a year in the world. But, you know, in the world, in this world that you that I'm living in now, if you make the Jonas Salk analogy, so Jonas Salk gets a ticker tape parade, right? I mean, church bells ring out, synagogues hold special prayer meetings. They announce it over Voice of America. Department stores stop and announce it, right? Now you're just blamed for being in the bucket of industry.
Yeah. You
know, I think there's something in between there. I think RFK Jr. said he thought I should be in jail. I mean, jailing me? How about just thank you? How about that?
Yeah.
That.
Okay. Well, so aside from reading all of your great books, and by the way, I highly recommend them. They are packed with great information, but they are very readable for a smart, you know, educated consumer. This is the way to go. But other than reading your books, what would you say to people who are concerned? They don't know exactly who to believe or what, you know, where to get good information, and they want to be fair minded about this whole issue. What's your advice to them?
That's the issue of the day. That is the issue of the day. I think we've gotten to the point where we don't trust our experts. We don't. I think science is losing its place as a source of truth. I think people simply declare their own scientific truths loudly and confidently. If you have an unusual belief, it's not hard to find people who share that unusual belief on the internet. And people believe they're being smart by rejecting that. I mean, there are in West Texas now, where you've had now 228 cases and 2 deaths, there are people who wear shirts that say unvaccinated, proudly. Wear shirts and say vaccinated. Like there, and I think COVID had a lot to do with this. I think that what happened in COVID, I think two things happened in COVID. I think when the virus rolled into this country in early 2000, I think we had our first death in February 2020. 2020 was when it came in, January, first death, February. But that year, we didn't have anything. We didn't have vaccines. We didn't have monoclonals. We didn't have antivirals. We just had a virus that could be transmitted asymptomatically. All we had was limit human to human contact. Closed schools, shuttered businesses, restrict travel, isolate, quarantine, mask, social distance. And people saw that as government overreach. And then year two, when we had a vaccine by December of 2020, now you have in 2021 mandates, right? You couldn't go to your favorite bar or restaurant or sporting event or place of worship until you were vaccinated. And people saw that as overreach. And they pushed back. They pushed back by saying the vaccine doesn't work. The vaccine is unsafe. So I don't want to be made to get it, or the disease is not that bad. And they were confident in saying that, even though amazingly thousands of people were dying a day. So you would think that they wouldn't be so confident saying it, but they were. I mean, certainly people in New York City weren't confident saying something like that because they saw it right in front of them. But maybe in other areas where were more sparsely populated, they didn't see that. And they thought they could get away without vaccinating. And so I think that's it. We leaned into this libertarian left hook, and I think we're still feeling the punch.
To what degree do you think the scientific establishment is to blame for the lack of confidence that people place in it?
Partly. I think even just the term scientific establishment, I think, is it, because it's really not, it's almost a contradiction term. Science at its best is open-minded. I mean, you can throw textbooks over your shoulder without a backward glance as you learn more and more. And that's the point. I mean, you don't know. You're always learning as you go. Nature gives up its secrets slowly. Throughout this pandemic, we were building the plane while it was in the air. And I think there was a level of humility that wasn't shown. I do. Mm-hmm. I think part of it is understandable in the sense that I think the powers that be were so desperate to get people vaccinated that they overpromised. You know, the notion that the vaccines were mandated, then you still got a mild or moderate infection, which was likely because the vaccine is really only designed to prevent severe disease. That's the goal of the vaccine. I think we didn't explain that early enough.
Yeah.
There were a number of mistakes that I think were made. It's always easy in retrospect, but I do think we were a little dogmatic, and it would have been nice to show some vulnerability and humility in this, and maybe that would have been better. Maybe not.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course, some people say that the minute you say, well, we're not sure, then, you know, the critics will say, oh, well, they don't know anything. They said they don't know.
Right, no, same thing, right? I've always said transparency is overrated, right? I mean, you're being transparent. Wait, you don't really know then?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, I think that's good. That's a really good starter for us. And I appreciate so much your taking the time to talk with me. And best of luck. We will keep our fingers crossed that it won't be as bad, or that maybe RFK Jr. will see the light, but not counting on that. but thank you so much. Both thank you for talking to me, and thank you for your tremendous contribution to public health as well.
Thanks for saying my pleasure.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week.
Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.